Well, welcome everybody. Glad to be together again, and we'll miss Peter. But we have a wonderful guest. I've known him for a good many years. I met him up on a mountain ridge in West Virginia. I think it even has a name, Chestnut Ridge, and it's outside of the nearest town, which is Philippi. And Rustin, welcome. I wonder what happened. How'd you ever get up in Philippi? Where were you born, and how'd you get up there on that ridge in the mountains?
Well, I was the middle son of a middle-class family in the middle of the country from Nebraska. And at 19, I became a Christian, and I started hitchhiking, and I met a traveling pastor. He was an African-American pastor here in Chestnut Ridge, and he was on vacation in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and he gave me a ride, and that was 35 years ago.
And he gave you a ride all the way to Chestnut Ridge.
Yeah, that's correct. He invited me to be a part of his ministry family. He'd raised 14 foster children, and his home was a place for guys paroling out of jail and struggling. And so I was one of a long line of people that just he picked up on the journey of life.
And while you were there, you went to the local college and then went on to a seminary?
Sure. Alderson Brought Us College is in Philippi, and it's an American Baptist school. So I was here 2 years before I enrolled and got a Christian studies degree, and then I went to Eastern Seminary and studied with Ron Sider. And my degree is Christian Faith and Public Policy. I personally have seen the welfare system as the single most negative influence on our community.
Huh. Say a few more words about that.
Well, from the middle of America, in Lincoln has great employment opportunities. I had known nothing about welfare and dependence, and so the whole pathology of welfare dependence really was a negative force that has been a lifetime of learning is how do you overcome dependence. And that's part of what the journey of New Vision is about, is actually not pointing at the problem, but actually working toward the solution.
Good. Now, let me ask, I'm just hearing a lot of interference. Maggie, are you, or are you, Rustin?
I'm okay.
My line is, yeah,
it's
my
okay.
Line is
it
very
stopped.
Clear.
Whatever it was, it stopped.
Okay.
All right. So you had your degree, and you stayed in the Chestnut Ridge, pastor of a local church.
Yes.
And, you know, usually people who have the kind of training and background you have are mainly focused on providing services to people.
Right.
Did you have that orientation when you started?
Well, only for 25 years until I met John McKnight. I think my spiritual orientation is service, and so that's how you solve the community's problems, is you find what the problem is and you figure out how to solve it with a service. And, you know, you were the first person that I met who just totally changed the entire paradigm of my life. And I thank you for that, though it's a real learning curve. And so, anyway.
Yeah, I didn't ask to get that answer. I didn't know that was the answer.
Oh, I know. But,
you did a shift away from
a major shift.
The typical kind of approach that we're going to serve and help and fix people, and began to think about the people on the ridge as people who had capacities and assets. And you've done a lot of kinds of things. I know one of the things that has impressed me is how you've gotten young people involved as productive people, like helping the elderly. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, I think one of the best assets of any community is, you know, the youth. And but the problem is a lot of kids see themselves as a problem rather than anything else. And so we incorporated the use of time banking strategies where when people did help, they received 1 hour of credit for that, and then they would use those credits to exchange with one another. It's funny, you know, a professor at the university wanted to learn how to drive a stick shift truck. So now I got one of the knuckleheads. Like, you know, he's a kid with a real edge, but he's been driving tractors and cars since he was 9. And the next thing you know, he's teaching the director of admissions how to drive a stick shift car. And small examples, but it empowers people when whatever they know how to do, they can help others.
How do you go about developing a consciousness and the knowledge of what young people might be able to offer? I mean, that's not how most people approach young people. But how do you find out what young people might offer?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, John Kennedy obviously put that out, don't ask what, you know, your country is going to do for you, ask what you can do for your country. You were the same way, as you taught us not to ask the question, what do you have need of, but rather, what do you like to do and what can you share with others? And that turns everything on its head when all of a sudden you're asking a young person, what is it that you like to do and you can do and you might be able to show others? Nobody asks kids that kind of question. And it's kind of being a matchmaker. Once a kid says, well, I can show somebody how to shoot a bow and arrow or, you know, skin a coon or whatever it is that they know how to do, then if you can actually get them to the place where there's somebody that needs to know or wants to know how to do that and they're a teacher rather than a problem, I think they're on the road to recovery.
That's a wonderful phrase. They're a teacher rather than a problem.
Right.
Can you say more about your idea about teaching?
Well, you know, I think unfortunately the world has gone a little bit where old teachers work for institutions and schools and colleges and all that. And, you know, I'm a neighborhood person, and I realize most of the things that I've really learned how to do that are practical in my life, some human being showed me how to do that. And we try and set up as many mentoring relationships as we can so that learning, you know, in essence, isn't just textbook or on the internet, but rather, you know, I learn better when I can ask questions of somebody who will take me serious and give me their answer than I do reading a book and a manual. I get confused when I read those how to assemble something diagrams. My brain doesn't work that way. So we love getting kids and adults together sharing ideas.
That's great. Now, tell us a little more about the time banking and the kinds of things that emerged from doing that.
Well, I think probably the single most important thing that we discovered in time banking is what it does to the value of the community. Everybody's hours become equal. And unfortunately, the money system of our world has taught us something really wrong, that some people are more valuable than others. In community time banking, everybody gives an hour of their time. They get only 1 hour of credit, and they exchange those. And the basic merging, and this is where Edgar Kahn brought that idea to us, and you're the one that taught us about asset-based development. Well, just gathering a list of who can do what is almost, it doesn't do anything other than, well, we got a great list. But what time banking kind of does is it mobilizes people to start using their assets and exchanging their gifts with one another. And those two things have to go together, I think.
That's an excellent point. It's first, you have to have some idea of what people have to exchange or to enter into the bank, and then you have to have a mechanism by which you make those kinds of connections. So ABCD and the time bank have always been a very compatible, friendly pair, I think, as we look around the country. Can you give us one or two examples of other kinds of connections that grew out of the time banking?
Well, you know, New Vision actually grew out of the time banking. We had one guy in our community who's a mad scientist. he's an electrical engineer, and he made his own solar panels from scratch. But he's a terrible carpenter and that kind of thing. And so he started teaching us, and different people in the community how to make renewable energy work. And in exchange, the people that were learning how to do that were over there helping to, do some of the physical work at his home. And now we had teenagers who were learning about STEM education and science. And in exchange, they were, one of them did some dog sitting for John. And it was just great to see him sharing his best gift and then receiving back some time from kids in our own community.
I remember visiting him. Can you describe a little about the place where he lived and the inventions that were going on there?
Sure. So John, in our escape from Czechoslovakia from communism, when he was 23, he came to Philippi as well and has lived here 35 years. When you come as a refugee, it's like coming as a hitchhiker. You only had the bags that are in your hand. So John is very gifted at trying to patch solutions together and use stuff that most people would see as waste, he would see as valuable. So, for example, he collects the waste vegetable oil from our local university, and he turns that into biodiesel fuel, and he hasn't been to the gas station in 9 years. Who wouldn't love to not have to go to the gas station? He made solar panels out of old shower doors that were donated to one of our ministry projects in town. So what we saw John doing was using his skill and creativity to overcome the cost of his energy. And he didn't have an electric bill, didn't have a home heating bill, and didn't have a gasoline bill when I finally got introduced to who he was. And I said, that is the power of community development. If one family can do all those things in our community, what would happen if we started becoming like a renewable co-op and we all started learning how to make our own power? And one thing led to another.
Now, I was surprised to learn that even as unmechanical a person as I could probably make solar panels. Can you describe that process?
Well, it's, the science of how sunshine turns to electricity is way complicated. But at the end of the day, to make a solar panel, you have to learn how to solder two wires together, and you have to learn which two wires have to be soldered where, and then how to put some of the material together. And that's a skill that everybody in our community so far has. So what we found out was it didn't really matter what we were doing as long as there was a leader in the group who understood what had to happen, and the rest of us got kind of good at figuring out how to follow directions as well as gain a little bit of skill. Soldering is, it just takes a little bit of practice, and the more you do it, the better you get, usually.
So you have kids, young people, making solar panels.
Correct. We are probably America's smallest manufacturer. We've made 180 solar panels from scratch. And that got us started into the renewable enterprise. And it wasn't long before we discovered that we could also make solar-powered lights for people in the developing world. And so most of our group time now has spent making solar-powered lighting devices for people that live in darkness.
And so what might one of these solar-powered light systems cost?
They're about $100. And what our young people do, and our whole community, is we deconstructed the process of how a light is made. It has LED strips. And then we use some reflective film that we got donated from the 3M Corporation. And we stick that on political signs that are headed for the landfill. We repurpose them and make a light out of them. They have a battery that charges a cell phone. And what we found is all the young people didn't necessarily need a light, but all the kids had their own cell phone. So we just challenged all the young people in our group to say, you need to go green a little bit. And if you have your own phone device, you need to charge it every day with solar power that charges your own battery. And sure enough, that got kids going in the right direction.
So you make chargers for cell phones that are solar.
Correct. Yeah. So this is where most people talk about renewable energy, but they don't ever do anything with it because they think they have to buy a great big system for their house. It's as simple as, why don't you start by every day charging your own phone with a solar-powered charger, and at least now you've made one step in the right direction. And that's what New Vision is about, doing something, not necessarily talking about doing something.
And keeping it in the world of simple technology rather than the more complex stuff that we seem to be surrounded with.
Yeah, there's certain parts of it we can't make a lithium battery work, but we can figure out what good batteries are. But we can connect wires, and you know, the lights we make are fairly simple fabrication. But unfortunately, we live in a world that's kind of now notarized by made in China, and like young people don't think they have the creative power to put things together, so they buy things out of a box, and when it doesn't work, they throw it away, and that's about as far as most people get in the area of making things, and we think that's destructive to the well-being of our community.
Now, if you think about your folks up there making these solar lights, one of the things you do with them is that you then send them to a community in Africa. And can you tell us what those lights mean to people in a village there?
So most of us have forgot about what it's like to live in the darkness. Sometimes the power grid gets knocked out in our own neighborhoods, and it reminds people. Literally today is another day where the sun just went around the earth and 4,000 people will die because of respiratory disease connected to cooking their food indoors and using a kerosene light. And over half of the people that die are kids under the age of 5. They say it's the equivalent of smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And the problem is when you're born into a family with no energy and your mom is cooking the food in the house and you got this kerosene can, it kills your lungs while your lungs are developing as a little baby. And so what we discovered is, gosh, the little light we make could alleviate that. And ultimately, one of the best gifts is when kids go to school, if when they walk back home and they do their chores, if they have a light, they can study and do their homework.
And have any of the people that you've shared these lights with in Africa themselves learned how to make them?
Yeah, that's part of our, you know, what makes us unique. Most people don't think our business will ever work because we spend too much time teaching people how to do stuff. But anything that we learn here in our own neighborhood with 6th graders and 9th graders, we feel like is a level of transferable skill. So it's give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Well, you know, it's the same thing with lights and anything. If you give people products, they're only going to be able to use them as long as the products work. If you teach people how to put the products together, when they start to have problems, people know what to look for so they can repair them and keep going. And so that's pretty much our model.
And you're doing that with people who live in African villages.
Absolutely. And all of them, we have lights in 33 countries of the world. We have about 2,500 lights. And our way we get those is there are people that go on mission trips and doctors that go on clinic trips. And so wherever we hear about somebody leaving the United States, heading to the developing world, we always say, well, why don't you, you know, pack one of these light devices in and take it with you and see what people over in the community are going to think about it. If you're in a dark neighborhood and somebody turns on a light, it gets your attention, and pretty soon there's a conversation. And most often what happens is people come back and they say, boy, that made a huge difference. How can we have more of those? And that's when we start to train them. When you go back this next time, here's the training you need to provide to people in those communities.
That's great. So, in a sense, you've become a ridge full of teachers.
Absolutely. And it's so this was the best thing that happened is John started teaching us how to make solar panels, and it became like a quilting bee. When women got together to make blankets, you know, I always thought they were making blankets, but really what happens is you create a bunch of friends, and the blankets are a good excuse to get together.
Mm-hmm.
The solar panels happen that way for us. It takes 8 hours to solder and make a single solar panel. And by the time we finished our first 36 solar panels, you can do the math on how many hours we had spent together. It took us 8 months. But when we installed the system on our own church, it was a magical day because we had done something for ourselves. You know, we didn't have to ask permission. We had to work with the power company. But when we turned the system on, literally we saw our church power meter go backwards. So in the world of dependency, where it usually just gets worse and worse and worse, we felt like we came around a corner and now we were going the other direction. But the most powerful thing was other people heard about what we did, and the next thing you know, people started coming to our community, not just to paint a house or put a roof on a, you know, an old tired building. They were coming and they were saying, can you show us what you're doing and how does it work? And so then we became subject matter experts in an area that we never would have thought about, but it's good for the soul.
That's wonderful. Now, I remember you telling me one time about playing basketball with, I think, your daughter.
Yeah.
And you had an idea that grew out of just playing basketball. Can you tell us that?
Sure. So we had went to the Dominican Republic to bring lights to a small school where the only power at night in that little village was the generator at the local bar. And the headmaster of the school was grieved because she said, I educate all these kids. And then when they get to be junior and senior high, on the nighttime, the only music and lights in our neighborhood is at the bar, and that's where they all go. So we agreed to go down to Cotuí and try and help bring solar lights to her little gymnasium so those kids would have an option. Well, when we did that, we put our lights way up in the ceiling, you know, kind of the conventional way that gyms are lit, where the court's below it. But we realized the lights weren't quite strong enough to make it sizzle and pop. Well, my family was on the trip, and my daughter wanted to play high school basketball. And one night, she was out shooting at our own court, and it was dark. And I didn't have a roof on my gym, so I said, what am I going to do with the light? And I taped the light onto the backboard, and so all the light was shining on the rim. And it became a magical moment because for the first time, you know, now I could see what it looks like. You could imagine being in the driveway and the backboard and the rim is just like beautifully bright, and it made playing fun again. But out of that experience, it was revealed that, you know, how to put lights onto a basket and a backboard. And we now have a provisional patent that we're very hopeful and very excited about, that of all the basketball rims in the whole world, that we would be able to get a driver to bring a light to those courts. And that's a powerful idea, so you can pray for us.
That's wonderful. So what you're doing is saying it may be that we can get people better at basketball if we light the hoop, for instance.
Yeah, well, so how do you get better at anything is you get better by doing it. And if you think about hot summer nights, most kids don't want to go inside and go to sleep. And if there's a light on their rim that is shining, what do you think most kids that like basketball are going to do?
Play. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's an ingenious idea, and it'll be interesting. You're waiting to get the patent approved?
Yeah, so we have the provisional patent, and now I think it's in November where we have to, you know, land. You get 1 year from the time you apply for the provisional, and we're currently looking for the right set of investors and probably a larger company who will become the distributor of the product, just so that it goes global quickly, and we hope to benefit some from our own intellectual property. And who would have thought we had intellectual property?
Yes, playing basketball with your daughter at night, right?
There you go.
That's it. Any other things that you've been involved with on the invention end of the world? It seems to be you're always creating something that we ought to know about.
Yeah, we, you know, it's a hungry world where water is probably one of the most scarce commodities. And so you realize right away when people are dying of starvation and there's not enough water, what's the solution? And this is the great thing about John, our mad scientist, is if you present a problem, his mind clicks into gear about what some of the solutions are. So there's something, it's called aquaponics, where you raise fish and vegetables together in the same system. In most of the communities where there's not enough water for the crops, at least there is a rainy season. And during the rainy season, it rains a little bit too much, and then it goes dry for 10 months. And during the rainy season, if you can capture 1,000 gallons of water, you can raise fish in that water in a tank. And as the fish eat, they do their waste in the water, and you pump the dirty water into beds of gravel where the plants are waiting for their vitamins. The roots of the plants eat all that waste out of the water, and the clean water goes back to the fish. So we have two aquaponics projects going, and now we're trying to figure out exactly all the details to help scale that and help other communities begin to raise their own food as well.
Yeah, I remember when we visited John's place, seeing that he had this system going of growing food and growing the fish as well in a little kind of greenhouse room. He's an amazing inventor, and he's you found him, right? I mean, he was hidden away there up in the ridge, and you found him.
So the funniest thing was, you know, my training was in trying to find best practices around the world. I work for an international NGO, and I literally would travel to other countries looking for good ideas, and this is what an asset-based director would know. Is probably the best idea that I discovered in 35 years of looking was right in the little town of Philippi with a guy that was doing all this stuff in his backyard. But what he doesn't have a vision for scaling any of his great inventions. He just likes inventing stuff. He'll go invent something else. And so he was right here in our own neighborhood, and now we're working together, and it's making a difference.
Now, that's fascinating. It might be interesting if, in terms of looking at neighborhood assets, we began to seek out inventors.
Correct.
As well as people who
I
have
didn't
other
see
kinds
that.
Of
I don't. Time. I don't think you've written a book on that yet, have you?
Yeah, right. but that's a that there got to be inventors everywhere. I think the whole system of modern technology and the internet grew up in garages, right?
Correct.
I think four major corporations that we know well, they started with a couple people in a garage. So.
Right.
Yep. That's a community asset that you've really identified and mobilized. Well, Maggie, I think we've got a wonderful background and a bunch of particulars that are very useful here. Do we have anybody who wants to join in?
We don't yet, John, but I'd like to invite people to either, if you're on the phone, to hit *8. Or if you've logged into the chat and would like to join the conversation by sharing a thought or a question or a reflection, we'd love to hear from you. It's really interesting, Rustin, to hear the stories. I particularly love the part about when the women were making the blankets, you thought they were making the blankets. And so much more goes on in those times and in building communities. You've got some great stories about giving and teaching. So really exciting to hear this. So if there are others who would like to join in, please do so. We have another several minutes on the call, however you'd like to stay on.
Let me ask while we see if there's somebody else who wants to join us. I know that you work from a spiritual base, and it illuminates and guides your work. And I wonder if you could say a few words about how everything you've been talking to us about in your mind relates to the spiritual life, Christianity, etc. What's
sure.
the connection?
Well, I think believing in God means that, you know, the world we live in is less luck and happenstance, and you're always looking for, you know, what is the hand of providence that's guiding what you're doing. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have been a part of our work for 30 some years, and it's like almost feeding the birds one kernel at a time. You know, I feel the, you know, kind of a spiritual leading toward good things getting better, you know, light instead of darkness, you know, hope instead of despair. You know, it isn't, once you read the teachings of Christ, you know, he, you know, has a way of giving you a set of values that I think lead toward a wholesome life, but a challenging one. And for me, just trying to be faithful where I am, I felt like when I met Reverend Peoples and he gave me a ride, that this is the place that I was destined, you know, by God to be. And now it's a question of, well, if this is the place, then what kind of person should I be? And then what kind of work should I do? And, you know, so every day there's a sense of a good reason to get out of bed. And there's always, it feels like you should always be trying to make positive progress in helping others help themselves. So that's kind of my connection, is every day. My church life isn't separate from my work as a ministry life. It's all kind of, it's just the way life is meant to be lived, I believe, is God's at the center. And then from there, he's meant to lead us into the future.
And what's impressed me as well is that you used the word there, a place, that you came to a place. Here you were raised in a city,
yeah.
Lincoln, Nebraska. You said you're a city boy.
Mm-hmm.
You're hitchhiking, right? Just as after you get out of school. And African-American minister picks you up and takes you up to this unusual place on the ridge. Nobody has much money. They've been there a long time, right? And you decide this is my place. And it seems to me that what you've been telling us about is what you've discovered in a place once you're committed to it. I mean, in my mind, you're not just an inventor. You're also a person who really understands and reveals, makes visible the assets in a place that most people would say there's not much here.
Right.
So, go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, the training that you provided was fundamentally a key. I was burning out ever so slowly and quickly. When you try and provide services to broken people, you know, you just get tired and you finally have to quit because you never solve anything. And also, I looked at people as a problem to be solved rather than trying to look at people for the gifts that they have to share. And it's a much better world when you're looking at people as gifted, capable people rather than broken and damaged.
Yeah. And once you understand that, the only thing you got to do is discover what's there, right? You know, it must be there. Well, that's wonderful. I don't know, Maggie, anybody want to join in?
Yes, actually, we do have one comment in, or question in the chat. Accepting the differences in people, in your experience, are people now motivated more to belong and have a sense of community or to produce together?
I think most people that live in kind of a defeated place want to feel like they're connected to something that's successful. It kind of gives them the courage to, you know, try again. So I think the more that our work that we're doing is feels successful, like not just one more place to give my time and struggle, we have found people more willing to contribute. All of a sudden they felt like, oh, my community has a good story and I can be a part of that good story. And that has been helpful to draw in some unlikely people who usually sit on the sidelines because they see the action as positive.
That's great. Anything else, Meg?
Yeah. How many staff and volunteers do you think it takes to do your work?
We have a 2.5-3 staff people, and then we probably have 400 or 500 volunteers that at different levels. In our community, we probably have about 30 people that would play a significant role in terms of their time commitment. It doesn't take a ton of staff or a ton of resources, but it does take some. And unfortunately, there's very few identifiable resources when you're trying to help people help themselves. There's a lot more charitable dollars when you're taking care of people that have bad problems. So.
And you also, I think, have the potential of taking this work so that it can begin to produce income that can be used appropriately to build your efforts.
Correct. I think, one of the biggest challenges that we have for Appalachian families is our population is actually, kind of an indigenous population that goes back to Native American heritage. And people like to work to live. They like to earn enough money. But when it's, when it's hunting season, some of our families, they like to go hunt. And sometimes you don't get your catch the first day. And so we've created a small economy where people can take parts of the work home with them, and they finish the pieces and they get it back and they're compensated that way. And it's a unique way to kind of create employment opportunities without getting yourself into, some of the challenging relationships when people don't want to work 52 weeks a year, 9 to 5. They still need revenue and income to feed their families, but our system of employment in America is not very accommodating to people that don't fit the 9 to 5 mode.
And that I think is wonderful insight, because one of the things that a lot of people who might listen to this webinar are working on is what encourages a local economy.
Right.
And a local economy is especially appropriate for people who, for all kinds of reasons, are not 9-to-5ers in
right.
that kind of a world, but have abilities, have time, have potential vision. And if a local economy is fostered, then they begin to find a place where they are. And it seems to me you're adapting that wonderfully.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that don't have a good car that can't get to, the job market in our area is 30 miles away over at the interstate where commerce happens, not in our own county where unemployment is high. So we've figured out some things that a few neighborhood residents are actually able to do now without leaving the neighborhood, and it brings revenue to their home.
Great. That's great. Well, anything else, Maggie?
No, I think that's about it for right now, John.
All right. Well, thanks so much Rustin, you're one of the wonderful local inventors, and we're so pleased that you'd come and share your understanding of what's in a community if you really seriously look at what people have to offer. And so let me turn it back to you, Maggie.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Rustin, for being with us today and sharing the stories. It's amazing how much can happen with few people and lots of great ideas and using the gifts that we all have. So thank you again for taking the time to be with us. Rustin's website is www.nvre.org. We hope you'll join us again next time, which is going to be on August 4 with our guest Ed Conboy. So until then, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us. I've just seen one comment come up saying, thank you so much for this exceptional hour. So I'll add my thanks to that, and we'll be closing for today, and see you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye, everybody.